I'm going to do the introduction when we actually play it back.
All right, I understand. Okay.
You had been married to a South African freedom fighter before actually moving to Ghana. Why did you decide to move to Ghana after the marriage broke up?
Well, the marriage broke up in Egypt. I wanted to put my son into the University of Ghana at Legon, which is really the greatest, or at that time was considered the greatest university on the African continent. I wanted him to go to a school and be in a country which were run by black people, so he could have that experience. I don't know how on earth young black people survive the racism, the hate, the disdain, and the abandonment in the United States of the larger society. I wanted to help my son to avoid that. We were there in Ghana less than 3 days. I had meanwhile expected that I would spend 2 weeks, get him all settled in, and I would go on to Liberia, where I had been offered a job in the Department of Information in Monrovia. So I thought that's what I would do. But you see, Terry, life so often, as soon as we get situated, get really comfortable, get our plans in order, life offers us tickets to somewhere, like Bombay, you know, or Ouagadougou, and then insist that we pay our own fare. 2 days after I was there in Ghana, my son was in an automobile accident. His legs were broken, his arm was broken, and his neck was broken. He was 17 years old. I was 33 years old. And so I stayed in Ghana. And as usual in my life, I was blessed to fall on my feet. You know, I mean, what to do? I had no choice but to come through and stay there and help him to recuperate.
Which he did.
Which I thank God he did. I went on to get a job. I got a job at the University of Ghana, thanks to F.Y. Sutherland. I began to write for the Ghanaian Times, got a job as feature editor of the African Review, which means that I created the double crossticks, anacrostics, crossword puzzles, and I wrote all the letters to the editor and answered them.
When you decided, well, I'll be settling in Ghana at least for a while because that's what fate had in store for you, did you think that this experience would be like going home because it was an African country?
Yes, I certainly did. And in a way, it was going home. In a very queer way, I have felt more comfortable, more at home in Ghana and in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, than in all the cities or countries I've lived in. And I have no way to explain that, because in Ghana, in many cases, I was not accepted, although I did my best to learn Fanti. But there were times when it was very clear that I was not an African.
But did you think that as a black American that you'd be given this welcome home ceremony by Africans when you arrived?
Not unlike Russian Jews going to Israel. You know, the black Americans were just like that. We arrived and some of us expected that as soon as we got to the airport, someone would roll out a really beautiful red carpet and the drums would start to play. And people would start to shout, "They've come home. Here they are. Come and welcome them." You know, well, the people really didn't have time for that. and the naivete, which really speaks of a blithering kind of ignorance, I'm sorry to say, of what was happening in Africa, our naivete, hid from us the facts and even the truth of what Africa was going through and had gone through. You see, when the African slave trade really became big business in the 18th century. Naturally, the people who were most desirable were the people who were stolen or taken or bought. So the strongest, the brightest people would fetch more money on the slave market. So Africa was denuded, stripped of its sons and daughters. And then it was already, of course, by that kind of action, made weak and vulnerable to colonialism. So colonialism had had its day in the African sun for, until 1957. Can't believe that hundreds of years go by of this sort of blight on the land and on the people's psyche. Well, 1957, for the first time in a country south of the Sahara, an African country got its independence. Mind you, Liberia and Ethiopia were never colonized, not truly. Ethiopia, of course, underwent the Italian settling in and blight. But for those two countries, but all the rest of the continent in the late 1800s had been cut up and divvied out in the Balkanization of the states of Africa. So by 1957, Ghana was just standing erect. It had been the Gold Coast. Another part of Africa was called the Slave Coast. It meant that it had never dealt as a controller of its own destiny, or had been hundreds of years.
When you went to Ghana expecting this big welcome home, you found that there were actually certain views that many Africans had about Afro-Americans and their behavior, which is kind of different from traditional African behavior. What were some of the views or almost even stereotypes that you thought Americans were up against in Africa?
Well, many Africans had never met black Americans. They knew nothing of what happened to us after our people were taken from the continent. Nothing. You see, during the 17th century in the United States, or what would become the United States, there were many whites brought here as bondsmen, bondswomen, and there were many blacks. And they were treated as slaves. They were, for all intents and purposes, slaves. But they could write back home. And so slave owners and bondsmen, or people who held the bond of those people, were reluctant to treat those whites really ill, because they could always write back to England or to Wales or to France or to Germany and say, this is what they're doing. Ships actually took mail back. But no ships took mail back to Africa. You see? So there was no chance that they would ever know what was happening to us. So the modern-day African, and I mean in the 20th century, only had movies. They had Jack Benny and Rochester. And so Rochester represented to many Africans what blacks were like. They had the Amos and Andy shows. So Amos and Andy, the Kingfish and all, represented to them what black Americans were like. Very few black Americans went to Africa except missionaries who would go even to southern Africa, East Africa, and West Africa to work in the church, AME, the CME, and so forth, the Baptist missionaries. They had no understanding of us, even into the 60s. So that there were young men and women who had come abroad to study, but they were very few. So the average African knew nothing about the black American. Amazing. One man with whom I became romantically involved, asked me, is it true that after slavery, the whites gave the blacks all their money, and now you all ride around in Cadillacs?
Were there things that were expected of you as a woman? Because it seems that the behavior of American women is a little different than the behavior of African women, that maybe you were considered to be more forward, more assertive.
Not really. Not in Ghana, because the Ghana market woman is a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was the national Ghana, or the women of Ghana, who brought Kwame Nkrumah back from England and supported him in his attempt to become prime minister and finally president. It was the National Council of Ghana Women, and they are very powerful. So my attitude, I learned, of course, that my grandmother, who had raised me, was really a Ghanaian market woman. She had no idea. She grew up in Arkansas. She owned a store and had land. And when I later saw the women of Ghana, I thought, So that's where Mama got that.
When you got to Ghana, did you change your clothes and your hair to fit in more, or to do the kind of thing that might really stick out in America, but you could feel perfectly at home with in Ghana?
Yes, I had changed my clothes earlier when I met and married the South African freedom fighter, Vusumuzi Maki. I had changed my clothes in the United States. He'd been here in the United States at United Nations as a petitioner against the South African horror of apartheid and oppression. And he had introduced me to Ghanaians, or to West African women, and some who were at United Nations then made me clothes. So I wore African clothes, West African clothes, from 1959. When in Egypt, when he moved to Egypt and I went with him, there were Ghanaians and Liberians, women who made clothes for me. So I had already done that. I had not had my hair strong. So it looks a lot like the fine braiding that is done in the United States, so popular now, the cornrows. But it's done with black string and wound very, very tight, small patches of the hair. And beautiful designs are made on the scalp. So I started having that done and continued all the time I was in Ghana. Sometimes I'd let my hair out, as they say, and it was very big. But most of the time I'd have it strung.
There was one time when you had it done in such a way that you didn't realize it was really for younger women and not for mature women who had already had children.
Yes. Well, I thought that the woman who had strung my hair, that was the first time, and she had left the spikes standing out. And they stood out, I mean, maybe 7 inches from my head, from my scalp. And I thought, my God, how awful. I mean, I looked like those terrible drawings of in the slavery books of pickaninnies, and how terrible. And I said to the woman, is this it? And she said, oh, no, I wouldn't leave your hair like that. I'm not a fool. She said, you are not a small girl to wear your hair like that. And she told me to sit down, and suddenly she pulled all these things together, all those spikes together, and they lay flat, and they looked so beautiful. And I loved it.
My guest is Maya Angelou, and her new book, which continues her series of autobiographical books, is called All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes. Malcolm X visited you while you were there, and it was shortly after his really momentous visit to Mecca. And he was, you describe an evening or an afternoon where he was basically speaking to a group of people in Ghana. And one of the people during the question and answer period, a young man, I think, asked him why he insisted on calling himself black when he was so light-skinned that he'd appear almost white to an African. Can you describe what he said in response to that?
Oh, it was so funny. He said, in the United States, where I come from, whites have called me everything. They have never, however, called me white. They who should know themselves and their own have never called me white. He says, blacks have called me everything, from Detroit Red, you know, all sorts of, some good things and some bad. But no, black people have always known I was black. And you see, that really, he made it into a very funny and fetching response. But from the 18th, I guess the end of the 17th, certainly into the 18th century, it was determined legally in this country that if a person had one drop of black blood, he or she was black. Well, now the black community has always accepted that, feeling, whether articulating it or not, that we need everybody we can get. So if a person just claims that he or she had a black great-grandmother, we take him. Yes, just fine, thank you, no matter what he looks like.
In the period of the 60s when you were living in Ghana, a lot of black literature in America and black politics was really being fueled by anger at seeing what was happening in America and seeing what was happening within the civil rights movement, the cruel ways that protesters were treated in the South. And you always refer to anger as being the thing within you that you have to work hardest to control, and Malcolm X even had a talk with you about controlling your anger when it was directed at other people. And I just wonder how you felt about that, because, I mean, so much anger really was and still is justified.
Yes.
and creates its own very positive energy, yet you seem to have had to negotiate how to use your own.
I still do. There's a danger with anger, that it doesn't turn into bitterness if it is not resolved. If the object of one's anger is not made different, then that anger can turn into bitterness. And so I work very hard. I think anger of itself is healthy. It's like fire. It burns everything up and clears the road for new and clears the ground for new planting. I think bitterness, though, is like cancer. It eats upon the host. It doesn't do a damn thing to the object of the bitterness. So I have to work very, very hard, and still do. I still speak out. I still raise my voice and money and energies and write books and plays and anything else against the brutalization of any human being. And as soon as I know it, the one who's doing it is the second one to know. But I work very carefully not to let that erode and metamorphose, change itself into something which I cannot control.
When you were living in Africa, you weren't yet a writer of books. You had written articles, but no books yet. And I wonder how the music there and the music of the speech there affected your own writing and how you heard language.
Well, I think I've been really more influenced by the Southern Black American preacher, much more than by the West African language or melody, which is about the same thing. I find in my poetry and prose the rhythms and imagery of the best, I mean, when I'm at my best, of the good Southern Black preachers, the lyricism of the spirituals and the directness of gospel songs and the mystery of blues are in my music or in my poetry and prose, or I missed everything. There's a blues. I was just thinking when I said the mystery of blues, I hadn't thought about that before. But there's a 19th century blues which asks this question. Have you ever had the blues so bad you could feel them in the palm of your hands? Now that's mystery, and that's poetry, and that's what I try for. So I think that maybe learning to speak Fante helped to train my ear. That may be, but I don't hear any of the African melody directly, contemporary African melody in my work. I hear Black American speech.
Did you grow up going to church a lot and listening to a lot of blues? And
I went to church. My grandmother took me to church on Sunday all day long, every Sunday into the night. Then Monday evening was missionary meeting. Tuesday evening was usher board meeting. Wednesday evening was prayer meeting. Thursday evening was visit the sick. Friday evening was choir practice. I mean, and at all those gatherings we sang. We sang long meter hymns, which are almost lost now, Terry Groves. It's a shocking, sad loss.
What's a long meter hymn?
A long meter hymn. In a long meter hymn, a singer, they call it, lays out a line, and then the whole church joins in repeating that line, and they form a wall of harmony so tight you can't wedge a pin between it, so that a person would sing, as long as I live and troubles rise, I'll hasten to his throne. Then everybody comes in. If I was there, I would sing, as long as I live. And then there are all these twists and turns and melodic accidents, harmonics, and accidental harmonics which take place, which are just delicious to the ear. And they're almost becoming extinct. Still in old churches, sometimes in storefront churches, and at the University of Indiana at Bloomington, one can hear them because the University of Indiana has done a serious job in trying to record them.
There really is a connection in your writing between music and your words. I find your writing very, very musical and just, you know, lovely to read.
Thank you.
It's not self-conscious at all, is it? I mean, you're not aware when you're doing it of what you're doing.
Well, the easy reading, Hawthorne says, easy reading is damned hard writing.
Yeah.
And I will labor over 3 or 4 pages for a month, pulling them to pieces, rewriting, until they sing off the page. They must sing off the page. And then a critic will give me a review and say, well, Maya Angelou has another book out. And of course it's great, but then she's a natural writer. You know.
Well, basically, now it's interesting you should say that, because I think of you as being a natural writer, because there's something very spoken about your language, although it's so obviously well-crafted, but it's not... It doesn't bear any of the marks of the work.
I hope not.
But I think of all those years that you weren't writing. I think of all those years when you were writing articles and editing, but you weren't writing books and probably didn't even know you were going to be writing books. And you hadn't been writing about your own life with the richness that good fiction, has. And I wonder if you felt it missing, if you knew that you'd be writing like that.
No.
Because it's always interesting when a writer isn't writing.
Yes,
you know?
Well, I never, I thought of myself, I thought I would be a poet and playwright. Those were the two forms I really enjoyed. I made my living as a journalist, of course, but I thought that I would just stick with those and I would become better and better and better. But in 68, I suppose, I was at a dinner. This is name dropping, but these were the people. James Baldwin had taken me over to see Jules Pfeiffer and Jules' then wife, Judy Pfeiffer. And we talked all night, and I really had to work very hard to get a word in because they're all great raconteurs. And the next day, Judy Pfeiffer called the man who is still my editor at Random House and said, if you can get her to write an autobiography, I think you'd have something. He phoned me a number of times, and I said, no, Robert Loomis. I said, no, I'm not. I'm not interested. I was going out to California. I had written a series for PBS, 10 1 hours. I wouldn't be bothered with that. Until he said to me, well, Miss Angelo, I guess it's just as well that you don't attempt this book, because to write autobiography as literature is almost impossible. So I thought, well, in that case, I'd better try. Well, I found that that's the form I love. I love autobiography. I love the form. It challenges me to try to speak through the first person singular and mean the third person plural.
That's right, because your personal stories end up being like metaphors for things that we've all experienced. That's, and I think that's why your readers get so emotionally involved, not only with your books, but with you and your life, because your life seems to just embody so much that we've all experienced.
Yes, and see, anybody's life could do that.
But you need that ability to transform it, which most of us don't have.
I understand. But I'm just saying that it is not the uniqueness of my life. It's just that I've found the form. It is the form I really seem to be able to stretch in. And with each book, I think I come closer to achieving what I mean. And I don't even know how to articulate what I mean. But I do believe that some young people today, or even 5 years ago, have begun to build on what I've established and will take that form further and further and continue to enrich it so that the autobiographical form will not be a quasi-literary form or be lumped sort of, you know, all autobiography, biography, history, it's blah, 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 you know. But really, its own art form.
Are there poems that influenced you when you were starting to write or that made you want to write?
Oh, so many. There's a poem called Sympathy of Paul Laurence Dunbar's. Mr. Dunbar wrote this about 1890. The first stanza is, I know what the caged bird feels, ah me, when the sun is bright on the upland slopes, when the wind blows soft through the springing grass, and the river flows like a sheet of glass, when the first bird sings, and the first bud opes, and the faint perfume from its chalice steals, I know what the caged bird feels. Oh, dear. The whole poem is so beautiful. There are three verses to it.
What else really influenced you?
Well, Shakespeare. I was very influenced, still am, by Shakespeare. I couldn't believe that a white man in the 16th century could so know my heart. If he could know my heart, a black woman in the 20th century, single parent, all the things I was heir to, then obviously I could know a Chinese mandarin's heart and the heart of a young Jewish boy with braces on his teeth in Brooklyn. It meant I could know, if he, over those centuries, could know me so, that he could write, when, in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state and trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed. I'm desiring this man's art, that man's scope, and with what I most enjoy, contented least.
Did you read a lot of poems to your son when he was growing up?
To my son, yes. He's a good poet, too.
He is a poet now, right?
He is a good poet. And each time he's had a reading, he precedes his reading by saying, reading his poetry, he says, first I must tell you some of the poems my mother read.
My guest is writer Maya Angelou, and she has a new volume in her autobiographical series, and it's called All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes. You've always had a very unconventional family life.
That's true.
That's one of the subjects you've always written about in your books. Your mother left you from the period you were 3 to 13, and your grandmother brought you up. And when you were a mother, well, even before you were a mother, let's start with when you were pregnant. You were pregnant when you were like 16 or something, 15. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's just so young. And the older you get, the younger it seems.
Yes, I know, isn't it?
I was just wondering if you'd ever thought, if you had the option to have an abortion, if you would have done it. And
no.
Uh-huh.
No. In fact, I tried very hard years later with various marriages to have more children, but I was never successful. And there was no reason given. I mean, I'm supposed to be all right, but... And I tried with a diligence, but to no avail. No, I would never.
Well, you know, the story is that if you're a teenager and you're pregnant and you're not married, that your life is going to be ruined. This is what a lot of people think, and you've certainly disproved that with your life.
I wouldn't encourage a young woman to become pregnant. I would not. Because it is not healthy to have the state look after a young person and her child. That's one. Two, a young person is not really qualified on her own without a very strong support system behind her to raise a child. If she is not herself raised. In my case, I really had a wonderful mom, a great brother. My brother was fantastic when I was young. And I had an independence. I would no more think of taking welfare than I would think of flying to the moon without a rocket. Because... it was pride, absolute. It had nothing to do with goodness of heart or, you know, niceness. It was just pride. I could no more see myself going to an office, having some white or black person tell me, now sit down there and I'll take care of you and we'll give you something. I would not have it. So I got a lot of jobs and did a lot of things. But I kept my son.
As a mother, you traveled a lot, and part of that was because you were a performer, you were
yes.
a singer, you acted for a while, and your work and your interests took you to many places, and teachers, I think, had criticized you because, well, you say in your new book that your son had been to 19 schools in 11 years, which
yes.
is really quite a tally. Did you worry about that at all and worry about whether your independence and your travels were going to be bad for your son? Did you torment yourself
no,
about that?
No, I never did. I didn't torment myself. I did think about it, but I had no choice. I had to work. And I thought, I was told by one psychologist that he needed, my son needed security. Well, I was his security. Wherever he went, or wherever we were, he could always be sure that that tall black lady smiling was there, and that was his mom. I was present. I joined the PTA. I mean, in so many cities. And sometimes, I mean, it was during the time when I wore outlandish clothes, outlandish get-ups, as old black people call it. I would wear a purple blouse and an Indian sari skirt and a scarf which had little mirrors in it, you know, little bits of things in it, and huge earrings and thong sandals and anklets which tinkled. And I would join the PTA because my son was in that school. And sometimes he was one of two or three kids, black kids, in the school. So it got so bad when he was about 10. He called me aside one day and asked me, "Mother, don't you have any sweater sets?" Poor thing. He just thought, "Mom, please, don't look so outrageous."
But that's an interesting thing, because a lot of parents who lead unconventional lives themselves have some feeling that their children would rather fit in than come from an unconventional family. Did you have a conflict with
that?
Yes,
because I didn't own any sweater sets and sort of pleated skirts. I had these get-ups. Some of them I got at the secondhand store, some at the Goodwill, some were handed down. Some I created on the spot by wrapping cloth.
But it wasn't just your clothes that were unconventional. It was your whole sense of life.
That's true.
And your sense of family.
That's true. So he just sort of gritted his teeth and said, "Oh, God, that's my mom." And recently, a few years ago, I think People magazine, or one of the magazines, did a piece on me. And the writer called Guy, by this time he's a grown man and he's a personnel analyst for the county of Sonoma in Northern California, and a very serious young man with a great sense of humor. And this reporter asked him, "What was it like to be raised by Maya Angelou?" He said, "Well, imagine a liner, a ship, going across very rough seas. Tied to the ship with a chain, anchored carefully, is a canoe." I was the canoe. Now picture the ship changing course at any time, always going back to check that the chain held, the canoe wasn't taking on water, and then off we'd go again.
What a great image. You, when you were a child, had something terrible happen to you. You were raped when you were, what, eight or
something?
Seven and a half. Did that make you very protective of your son, knowing the kind of trauma that you can experience as a child and what lasting effects that could have?
Not terribly. I mean, it kept me aware. But I never wanted to stifle him. Never. So I tried to live, however wild my life may have seemed to outsiders, I lived a very protective and normal, I thought, life. My son had a bedtime, and that was when he went to bed. No guests stayed over. There were no chances of anybody taking advantage of or molesting my son. Gentlemen friends I had, I never had a man stay over in my house unless I was married to him. After Guy would be in bed, sometimes I would go out and stay till dawn and rush home and put on my gown and dressing gown just in time for him to wake up, and he'd say, "Hi, Mom, you're up so early. Oh, good." And he would try to hold conversations with me. I'd be so sleepy. I would sit there propped up by my elbows on the table, saying, yes, yes, thinking, go to school so I can go to bed. And somehow it worked.
Was it harder for you than you think it would be for most parents when your son Guy grew up and became independent because you had devoted so much of your life as a single mother to taking care of him and just, it seems that always so much of your, so much of your home was him, was having him. And I think it's always difficult for parents to lose their children to adulthood, but I wonder if it was maybe especially hard for you.
Well, you know, all comparisons become odious.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I don't know, but sure. It was very hard for me because he had been home to me. Wherever we were, he was home.
And you really relied on each other because you were traveling so much of
That's
the time.
Right. That's right. So when he started not only untying the apron strings, but unraveling the cloth itself, I couldn't believe it. I kept my own counsel. I learned long ago that it is wise with a growing person to keep one's counsel, not to flip out and shout and say things in anger, because they are so vulnerable. When you represent home as the single parent, or even if it's a mother and father there, you have no idea how much a frown can change the whole climate of the day for a child.
One of the things that really upset you during the period you were living in Ghana, the period you write about in your new book, was, and this is, I think, when he was 19, your son was seeing a 36-year-old woman, and you were just appalled. You were a year younger at the time, but you don't tell in your book whatever happened with that.
Well, he did go on seeing her. I told him that I wouldn't stand for it. I mean, it was terrible. And he said, oh, mother, please. And there's nothing so supercilious as a smart 18-year-old. I mean, so I said, I will knock you down, knowing very well that I hadn't hit him since he was 7. And by that time, he was about 6'2". And so he looked down on me and patted my head and said, yes, little mother, I'm sure you will. And I was really, I didn't know what to do. I knew that I dare not say anything to the woman, because he, as a young man, would consider I had intruded upon his private life, and he would be absolutely right. I thought that my displeasure would make him drop the affair, but it wasn't so. It was his introduction to sex and male independence, and so it was too precious to be dropped. And I understood it, although I hated it. I couldn't do anything about it. I wouldn't.
I had read in a magazine that when he did get married, that there was they separated, and there was, it wasn't to this woman, I don't think, but there was a custody fight, and he got custody, but she had kidnapped the child. And it just seems, I don't know, my heart really went out to you, because having worked so hard to keep family together, to lose a grandchild like that.
The only.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to say the grandson is with my son again.
Oh.
Thank God for that. And he sees his mother. Thank Guy for that, because Guy's arranged so that the mother and her son can be together quite a lot. Guy is not vindictive. He was terribly hurt, almost, well, very, very seriously hurt. But it was a terrible 4 years, awful, horrible. It injured the entire family.
Are you going to write about that?
I've written a small piece. I don't know if it will be published. I don't think so. I don't want to add fuel to the fire. I know that that family, the mother's family, and my family, or Guy's family, are inextricably linked together for the rest of our lives through this boy. And we will all have to display incredible intelligence and courage so we do not further harm the boy. So I would rather not.
So there's times with your own life that you won't write something if it seems
absolutely.
Like it's...
Right. Many times.
When you were young, you went through a period of, I think, several years of not speaking.
Yes.
Was it because of the rape?
Yes.
What do you think that you developed a sense of language through all those years of listening and not speaking? I think of the memory that you have, of the facility for language that you have, and of all those years of not speaking, what was happening in
yes.
your mind?
Well, I think I thought of myself as a giant ear. Something out of Gary Larson. A giant ear, which could just absorb all sound. And I would go into a room and just eat up the sound. And I memorized so many poets. I just had sheafs of poetry. Still do. I would listen to the accents. And I still love the way human beings sound. There is no human sound, voice, which is unbeautiful to me. I love them. And so I'm able to learn languages because I really love the way people talk. And when I was very young, blues singers used to come walking through the South with cigar box guitars, really a cigar box and a piece of wood and catgut strung along it. And they'd come around the store and sing. And the fellows from the Brazos of Texas had a sound which was absolutely Texan. And they'd sing, I'm just running around here, baby, I'm done. Think about you, well, now I'm done. Loving you, baby, well, anything you do. Oh, it's so gorgeous, I could pull my hair out. Then the guys who had come from Mississippi and a portion of Louisiana had another sound. They would sing, babe, please don't go. Babe, please don't go. Babe, please don't go back to New Orleans. They feed your rice and bean. Where you ever seen? Babe, please don't go. And it was way back in the mouth, see? So I would listen. Just fantastic. I still get excited about any human being speaking or singing.
Isn't it amazing how that period of being mute probably, in its own way, helped you become the writer that you are?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm amazed, too, at how you were able to mimic other people's sounds when you weren't using your voice all through that period.
But you could tell what they were doing because my grandmother spoke like that. She always had a deliberate way of speaking, see. And I would watch and I would know how she was going to say. I mean, when the rest of the word would come out, I knew. And I didn't think I was mimicking, but I could replicate it in my mind. After hearing somebody speak once or twice, I would know what their rhythms would be.
How did you start to speak again after you'd stopped?
Well, Mrs. Flowers, a lady in my town, a black lady, had started me to reading when I was about 8. Really reading. I was already reading, but I mean, She started me to reading in the black school, and I read all the books in the black school library. And she had some contact with the white school. And she would bring books to me, and I would just eat them up. And when I was about 11 and a half, she said to me one day, I used to carry a tablet around on which I wrote answers. And she asked me, do you love poetry? So I wrote, yes. It was a silly question for Mrs. Flowers, and she knew I just. She told me, you do not love poetry. You will never love it until you speak it, until it comes across your tongue, through your teeth, over your lips. You will never love poetry. And I ran out of her house. I thought, I'll never go back there again. She was trying to take my friend. She came to the store, and she would catch me and say, you do not love poetry. Not until you speak it. I'd run away. And every time she'd see me, she would just threaten to take my friend. And finally, I did take a book of poetry, and I went under the house and tried to speak. And could.
Did you have to find your own voice after those?
Oh, yes. I'm still, for years I did. I didn't even know where it was placed, for that matter. And then I didn't trust it. I was afraid of, not said this before, but I was afraid it might leave. You see? Since I had pushed it away so long, it might, on its own, just take off. And then muteness is much like any other addiction. It stands just behind my eyesight, just behind my shoulder, in critical moments when a marriage ended, which I thought would never end. It stands there offering itself to me, saying, I've got something for you. Come to me.
I'm really surprised to hear
it's
that.
It's terrible.
It's tempting to not speak.
Delicious.
I guess hearing that from someone as eloquent as you makes it even harder to understand, because you could use language to any effect.
No. It's so tempting that when I'm really in bad shape, I sing. And my mom and my son will find me wherever I am and stay with me and see me through that period, because it's there, it's saying, come.
Right.
I can make life so simple for you. You'll never have to explain anything again.
When you went to Ghana, you were searching for a home, but you left Ghana after about a year or so and went back to America. And you've lived where you're living now in North Carolina
Yes.
for a few years, and you have a permanent position at a university there that, you know, you can keep as long as you want. It's a lifetime professorship. Do you feel like you have your home now? Does that really feel like home, or is part of you still searching for home?
No, I believe North Carolina is my home. I really believe my home is in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I know, however, life offers wonderful, and by that I mean full of wonder, chances. I expect to be in Winston-Salem the rest of my life. My books are there, my paintings are there, my friends are there, and my work is there. I love the university, Wake Forest. However, I will not pretend to myself or anyone else that I think I have any position forever. I know better. I know life. Now, it might turn out, but if something happened today, I know how to call movers, and I would just have to go. It would break my heart right now to even think about leaving. But I'm not, I will not fight change when it is relentless. If something comes up and I have to move on, then that's just one more move I will have to make.
One more brief question. For years you avoided the South and wouldn't even go there for speaking engagements, and now you're living in it. What changed your mind?
The town of Winston, actually the university, and more directly, meeting three people there, three Southern whites, well, two Southern whites and a Norwegian, on an overnight stay there, just to lecture at the university. I met people I thought, my goodness, if I lived near them, we'd have dinner once a month. And then I left. I thought I'll never see them again. I was invited back to Wake Forest the following year to give a lecture. I gave the lecture and made more friends, black and white this time. I was invited back the next year, and the circle enlarged. And I became friends with the provost of the university and his wife, who's a fantastic poet. So, it was amazing. The people kept appearing and adhering to my heart. And I always thought, well, someday, because I was offered a position at Wake Forest, and I thought someday when I'm much older, you know. And then 5 years ago, when my marriage ended, I thought I wanted to give California a rest. Yes. And I looked around the country. The only places which really appealed to me were Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Winston-Salem. And I already had a group of friends, of artists, of professors, of church members, of choir members, of people in the Jewish community, in the black community, in the white community, in the rich and poor. I already had them. So I just moved on to Winston. And it's my home.
I'm glad.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much. You should come to Winston sometime.
I'd like to.
Have you ever been?
I drove through it once and stopped at a small store and bought some cigarettes. And about it, yeah.
You should see it in the spring. There's a great black poet, Miss Anne Spencer, 19th century poet, who loved Virginia. And she wrote a poem, "Alas, Poor Browning Never Knew Virginia." Virginia, heaven is Virginia, I'm sorry, heaven is Virginia when the year is at its spring.
That's great. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.